This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the roller coaster ride in Washington is over. They have passed a continuing resolution and addressed the budget crisis, at least for now, but it's had a big impact on millions of Americans across this country.
Mark, I think we have managed to avoid disaster, but done with a tactic just too familiar too often, kicking the can down the road to be dealt with at another time.
My hope is that this is a lesson for both the House and the Senate, that they have to come together in a bipartisan way to move the agenda forward.
And as part of the deal, conservatives in the House demanded additional income verification for folks enrolling in the online insurance marketplaces under Obamacare. But income verification was already part of the law's requirements and part of the exchange application.
It really was, and we'll see how all of this gets carried out over the next few months.
And speaking of the Affordable Care Act and the exchanges, those exchanges have been up and running for a few weeks now. Kind of a tale of two nations. The states that set up their own exchanges, at least on a technical level, have reported a much smoother process. But in the states, 36 of them that are relying on the federal exchange, they've really been bedeviled by IT problems since the beginning.
There are some, as you said, some very good activities going on in different states, and hopefully that will spread across the country.
And people out there have been trained to help people. One group is Enroll America. That's a national volunteer organization that's deploying people to assist in the online application process, especially in the states that haven't developed as much support as they may need.
And you can find out more about Enroll America by going to enrollamerica.org.
And in spite of all the focus on enrollment in the Affordable Care Act, dramatic change is happening every day in healthcare. And our guest today knows a lot about that. That's Dr. Dennis Charney, the dean of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, where they are undergoing a massive transformation in their health system, as well as in the medical school that trains the health professionals of the next generation.
You know, they are making big data a central player in their restructured medical school program, as well as in their health system. Dr. Charney will tell us about the changes underway that are transforming their approach to training the next generation of medical professionals. It looks like an interesting model for other medical training institutions to learn from.
And we will also hear from Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, who will be looking into some false claims about health reform that have been spoken recently in the public domain.
No matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Dennis Charney in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Government is back in business after a weeks-long shutdown, and what did it cost the American economy? About $24 billion, according to estimates from Standard & Poor's rating agency. Wall Street analysts predict dire consequences if Congress doesn't get its act together soon. China has already downgraded its rating of the American Treasury bonds due to the shutdown, near default, and unresolved debt ceiling issues. What didn't make it past the shutdown was a GOP attempt to repeal the medical device tax. It's part of the Affordable Care Act designed to help raise funds to pay for the law. Meanwhile, things are churning along slowly on the federal health exchanges while they remain open. Some predict many weeks or even months of round-the-clock troubleshooting before that system revs up to full speed. And while they're running more smoothly for the most part, there are glitches and hang-ups on the state-based exchanges. On the whole, states are doing a fairly good job of assisting residents in signing up for coverage. And simultaneously, it's time again for open enrollment for Medicare coverage. Seniors are being urged to really read the fine print this year. A number of plans may have different coverage than the previous year, seniors being told not to assume their coverage will remain the same. Mirror, mirror on the wall. What city's the largest drug consumer of all? When it comes to Medicare prescription drug consumption, the winner is Miami. The average senior in Miami spent close to $5,000 per year on prescription drugs. Many in the high-risk categories, the national average is about half that. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Dennis Charney, Dean of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York and President for Academic Affairs. Dr. Charney is a professor of psychiatry, neuroscience, and systems therapeutics and is a world expert on neurobiology and the treatment of mood and anxiety disorders. Dr. Charney has several patents to his name and is author of over 700 published articles and several books, including The Neurobiology of Mental Illness and Resilience, the Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges. Dr. Charney is a former scientific director at the National Institute of Mental Health and a member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science. Dr. Charney, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm happy to join you today.
Well, the Affordable Care Act has been keeping you and your organization quite busy. The Mount Sinai Health Systems in New York City recently gone under a significant transformation, including the creation of an affordable care organization. You've also been thinking hard about training that next generation of healthcare professionals as a necessary approach to preparing your organization and the country for its future challenges. Tell us about your vision for the redesigned healthcare system in the age of the Affordable Care Act, coupled with significant technological advances.
I'm happy to. As you may know, concluded an agreement to merge with the Continuum Health Partners system to form the Mount Sinai Health System, which now consists of 7 hospitals, a large ambulatory care network associated with a single medical school, and that's the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Mm-hmm. The healthcare system will be responsible for 2.5 million outpatient visits, almost 40% of the discharges in Manhattan here, and it allows us to develop innovative methods of delivering outstanding health care to a large population, which is a key component of the Affordable Care Act. And as you mentioned, we also have an accountable care organization, an ACO, which looks almost like an experimental way in the beginning to determine how can we lower the cost of health care while improving quality. So through these two processes, one is now having one of the largest health care systems in the nation with a single medical school, and the ACO, we're developing novel methods to deliver health care.
Well, Dr. Charney, I'd like to ask about the work that you're doing with assembling data for population management. I understand that you're investing significantly in a data hub, that you've hired the original or one of the original data scientists from Facebook and a growing team to figure this out, and at the same time also are building a biobank at Mount Sinai where genetic information can be stored and then incorporated into your data stream to get better insights into effective treatments and I imagine personalized treatment as well. Maybe you could share with us, you have so much going on simultaneously. Where are you in the process of setting up this massive data infrastructure, and when do you think you'll begin to see impact?
So one of the key elements of being able to provide great care in a large healthcare system is that you must be data-driven so that you know what factors relate to patient wellness, what factors relate to readmission, and how do you create an approach to wellness and primary care that ultimately enhances the health of your community. In order to be able to do that, you need to have expertise in what is now called big data analytics and how that might relate to delivering healthcare. Eric Schatt is the head of our Department of Genomics and Multiscale Biology. He's one of the pioneers in big data analytics, and he helped us recruit Jeff Hammerback, who you alluded to, who used to work for Facebook and helped develop the large data analytic platform for Facebook. And Jeff Hammerbacker, who is now an assistant professor here and is working with Eric Schatt's team, has decided to take his skills that he developed at Facebook and devote that to biomedical research and healthcare delivery. In order to accomplish this, we've had to invest a lot in high-performance computing systems. And apparently, when you invest enough, you can name your computer. So we have a computer that now is called Minerva, which is the goddess of wisdom. Right. And that computer is the infrastructure that is required to analyze a really enormous amounts of data from our electronic medical record, from our genomics program, put it all together and help us make clinical decisions for the benefit of our patients. And I'll just give you one example of how that actually works. The ability to sequence the human genome has gone down enormously in cost, so that shortly the cost of sequencing one's genetics will be at the level of a lab test. We now take genomic data, we put it together with one's clinical data, and so that at the point of care, our doctors can now have information that enables them to make decisions based on the patient's genetics in terms of what drugs they are given to get the best outcomes.
Well, that is exciting. But first, we've heard from a lot of folks who've come on our show about the difficulty of dealing with the silos in healthcare. And it's taken a long time to build them, and deconstructing the system while continuing to deliver care can be a real challenge, sort of the proverbial flying the jet and changing out the engines at the same time. And you're not only breaking down silos within your system, you're also partnering with some exciting external partners like Rensselaer Polytech Institute to seek outside assistance in system transformation. So how are you achieving this transformation on such a large scale while Mount Sinai continues to treat 2.5 million outpatient visits? That's a lot of balls to keep up in the air. Tell us how you're doing that.
You know, we spent about a year developing plans to integrate the systems and determine, you know, how to achieve excellence throughout a 7-hospital system. And so even though we only recently actually merged, the planning had been going on, you know, for a year. And just like you said, we had to continue to deliver outstanding care while we merged the systems. So we have figured out ways how to do that. We have had lots of meetings of the leaders of our different departments and institutes. And ultimately, what we're going to develop is clinical centers of excellence throughout the Mount Sinai healthcare system, such as diabetes, HIV, pulmonary disease, and primary care. And in fact, one of the key ingredients for achieving wellness in a population is to have a very strong primary care network. So all these initiatives began before we completed the merger, and now we are hitting the ground running to literally change healthcare in Manhattan. We are also investing a lot in innovation, and that's where the partnership with Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute comes in. More and more, digital medicine is going to be important in how we deliver healthcare, so that more care can happen literally in the home and not in a hospital or outpatient clinic or doctor's office or in the hospital itself. And we can do that because of the advances in digital medicine. It allows you to take blood pressure and measure glucose levels and to do EKGs literally in the home. We can communicate in a very robust way with our patients, you know, while they're in the home setting. And so that offers a lot of advantages because literally what's important about achieving health is being healthy in your community and you're in your home. So we're going to take advantage in part with our partnership with RPI, which has a lot of expertise in digital health, to literally have a healthcare system that starts in one's home.
Well, Dr. Charney, I know that there's a very core focus also on your mission of training and teaching and training that next generation to be the providers and the scientists and the leaders in this transformed system. And I understand that you're committing really quite a massive investment, $2 billion, towards a plan to thoroughly transform that medical training program to focus on some of these changes, to focus on translational medicine, utilizing the emerging tools in biomedics and genomics and other technologies, as you've described. Maybe you could share with us some about this new training approach, how you're doing that.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we are in the middle of implementing a $2 billion plus strategic plan that goes from conducting very basic research that ultimately we hope will lead to cures for serious medical diseases through the kind of care we currently deliver patient. And the ultimate goal of the strategic plan is to make discoveries that change the way medicine is practiced, whether it's through novel approaches to digital health, as I mentioned, or the discovering of new medicines for cancer or heart disease or serious mental illness. To achieve that, though, we have to be training literally the best and the brightest medical students, graduate students, and other trainees. And we want to have a culture of entrepreneurship that our students think out of the box, almost like a Silicon Valley approach to training and discovery. So in order to do that, we have revamped our medical training curriculum and even the way we admit students to our medical school. We are actively recruiting medical students from disciplines that typically have not thought of going to medical school, like students with expertise in computer science and mathematics, engineering, and physics. We are teaching our students how to be entrepreneurs and innovative and literally think that they can change, you know, medicine early in their career. So what that's done is lead to a culture of, you know, excitement and innovation here, starting with our students and ending with the patient experience.
We're speaking today with Dr. Dennis Charney, Dean of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Dr. Charney is a world expert on neurobiology and the treatment of mood and anxiety disorders, and oversees one of the largest collections of National Institutes of Health Studies. Dr. Charney, a significant focus of your work is in conducting research, and your specific area of expertise is in psychiatry and neuropharmacology. The sequester obviously had an enormous impact on the NIH budget and to the shutdown completely. Tell us about some of the exciting research that you are doing, but also the impact on the lack of adequate funding for NIH and the shutdown is having on your larger plans.
Yeah, you know, as Dickens wrote, it's the best in times and the worst of times. It's the best of times in that we've never had so many tools to discover the causes of serious medical diseases and based on that to develop new treatments. We're making rapid progress in discovering new approaches to the treatment of cancer. In mental illness, our scientists have discovered new approaches for the treatment of depression and are working very hard at developing better treatments for serious diseases early in life like autism and late in life like Alzheimer's disease. Our microbiologists have discovered new methods to develop a universal flu vaccine. So you wouldn't have to get a flu shot ultimately every year, but maybe every, you know, 10 years. There's just so many, you know, exciting things now happening. But the problem is that we're not getting the funding we need to accomplish what we know we can now accomplish. The sequester resulted in, you know, literally a decrease in NIH funding in real dollars. And when you take into account inflations, it was a substantial decrease. And the nation's health depends on research funded by the NIH. And with the shutdown in the government, all new applications stop being evaluated. And it's very important for your listeners to make contact with their representatives to get them to fund the NIH, the National Science Foundation, so that we can achieve the potential that we currently have, and that is to change medicine and the practice of medicine in a very rapid way like never before.
Dr. Charney, I know your own personal clinical and scholarly and research focus has been in the fields of psychiatry and neuroscience. You've written extensively on the subject, including the neurobiology of mental illness and last year's critically acclaimed Resilience, the Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges, aimed at the general population. And I think there is a increased understanding in the population, both on the impact and the outcomes of adverse childhood events, and certainly with our returning veterans from the wars, of the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder on people's lives. I wonder if you could share with our listeners what you see as breakthroughs in these areas of dealing with problems like post-traumatic stress disorder.
My own research has focused on discovering new treatments for depression and anxiety disorders. And in addition, and more recently, over the past 10 years or so, with a colleague, Stephen Southwick from Yale University, we have been studying resilience, and that is the ability to overcome serious traumas in one's life that we all experience at some point, and to literally experience a growth from overcoming challenges. We identified people who were resilient, who had overcome very difficult things in their life. We studied prisoners of war, victims of earthquakes in Pakistan and poverty, women who had to overcome the ravages of rape. And through all that work and literally interviewing and getting to know hundreds of people, we developed what we consider a bit of a prescription or a roadmap to become a more resilient person. And anybody can become more resilient. And so you want to develop the psychological toolbox to be able to handle that stress in your life. And that's been the result of our work on resilience, to develop a prescription for resilience so that you can literally train yourself to become a more resilient person.
Well, you have a conference coming up, the second annual Sinai Innovations Conference, that will focus entirely on emerging notion of team science. You have a pretty great and diverse panel of experts attending from healthcare, technology, arts, sports. I believe you have Yankees manager Joe Torre is participating. Tell us about this new approach to team science and the impact it's poised to have on the future of healthcare.
Yeah, you know, as Hillary Clinton has written, you need a village to accomplish great things. And that's certainly now true in biomedical research and innovation in healthcare delivery. You can't do it by yourself. You literally can't make major discoveries in a single lab anymore. You need teams of people working together to make discoveries that make a difference. To really make fundamental progress, you need to function as a great group where you synergize. And one of the reasons we asked Joe Torre to participate is, you know, he did win 4 world championships with the Yankees.
Right, it's a good reason.
And we thought we can get advice from, other areas on how to you bring people together to achieve greatness.
We're speaking today with Dr. Dennis Charney, Dean of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York and President for Academic Affairs at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. You can learn more about his work by going to mountsinai.org. Dr. Charney, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
You're welcome.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, the medical device excise tax that's part of the Affordable Care Act got some attention recently. A day after the House of Representatives voted to repeal it as part of a budget resolution, House Speaker John Boehner said that the medical device tax, quote, is costing us tens of thousands of jobs that are being shipped overseas. The excise tax is 2.3% and falls on clinical medical devices, things like CAT scan machines, stents, and other devices sold to hospitals and healthcare providers. It doesn't apply to consumer devices purchased directly by the public. The tax went into effect in January of this year, and since businesses can deduct excise taxes, the net effect is about 1.5%. It's true that some companies have announced the elimination of several thousand positions, not just in the United States, but around the world. But we found no evidence that the number has reached the tens of thousands, as Boehner said, or that all those jobs are going overseas. The Republican National Committee and a lobbying group called AdvaMed have compiled clips of medical device companies announcing job eliminations. The list shows 12 companies announcing the elimination of at most 8,725 positions. Most companies didn't blame the reduction entirely on the medical device tax, and a few made no mention of the tax at all. Medical device companies are also making large investments overseas, but those are driven in large part by growth in emerging markets, including China, India, Brazil, and Russia. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Walking sounds simple, but it's tricky business when you've lost a limb. And with the proliferation of IED explosions and our recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've seen the devastating effects of these injuries too frequently. But all of these amputees have spurred a new rush in science to build a better prosthetic. Traditional artificial feet and limbs do a pretty good job of getting amputees on their feet again, but they have limitations, and on average, amputees take a fall at least once a year because of a lack of proficiency of the artificial limb to function naturally. Scientists at Michigan Tech have developed a computerized bionic limb that pivots and rotates just like a natural ankle would, allowing for better balance while in motion.
It allows the foot to roll side to side. It allows the wearer to turn more naturally.
Professor Mo Rostgar, lead developer on the team, says that what really makes all the difference here is that their bionic limb has computer sensors on the bottom of the foot that alerts the limb to potential changes in gait.
If you have the same kind of mechanism in the prosthesis in the ankle that we have, eventually it allows better stability for the amputees. It prevents them from falling.
He teamed up with researchers at the Mayo Clinic who are helping to refine the prosthesis and test its reliability.
It has cables, so it allows us to move the electrical motors that are in the device virtually anywhere that we want.
A bionic artificial limb that uses advanced microprocessors to facilitate more natural walking for amputees, improving their safety as well as their dignity and quality of life, Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.